You're listening to Vatican Radio. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. What I'd like to do now is shine the spotlight on the Catholic Church and the United States at the time of the Second Vatican Council. To do this, I'll be bringing you an interview focusing around the question, how did the Catholic Church in the United States react to the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council? How did it receive the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy? And again, how were the popes of this council, Blessed John XXIII and Pope Paul VI, perceived by the American Catholic faithful of the time? My interviewee on this occasion is well-known author, church historian, Jesuit Professor Gerald Fogarty. Was the American church viewed as progressive in those days?
It was viewed as progressive, but behind the scenes was this developing resistance. It began with the liturgy. It carries through on social teaching, resistance that had already begun by 1961 with Mater Magistra, where there's a group of conservative Catholics that said Mater si, Magistra no.
Then, so in other words, Mother yes, but teaching no.
It was
John the 23rd's.
That's right. It was his encyclical, which was the 70th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, the first papal
social encyclical by Leo the 13th.
Yeah. What was interesting, by the way, there's been a long dissertation done in Germany recently on the American influence on causing the Pope to issue that first encyclical in 1891, because the American Church was mainly of the working class. So therefore they formed labor unions, so therefore the American church supported labor unions and supported the right to strike and things like that. By 1961, many American Catholics were now middle class, so they couldn't see the point of this. And it's gotten worse, and that's come to the present, where now you have many, many, many Catholics who argue the church should not be involved in the social order at all. But, yeah, initially probably the American church was looked at as being progressive, but behind it was still not much of a development of theology. There was development. When I say development, I'm talking about people becoming outstanding theologians and really being concerned about it. And in my opinion, that stopped now. You know, there's no one field that stands out as would have been true 25 years ago.
The council was called for by John the 23rd, and Paul the 6th inherited it. What was the perception of the Catholic Church, United States, of these two popes?
Well, I remember I was a young Jesuit student at the time. I was doing a PhD in history. And a lot of people were concerned that this looked like a reversion back to Pius XII, but people, of course, didn't know anything about Pius XII other than he appeared to be austere and so forth.
So and Paul VI was...
Was a throwback to Pius XII, in which in many ways you would expect him to be because he worked on Rome for so long. And I was at a dinner party one night, and George Lindbeck, who was one of the Lutheran observers to the Second Vatican Council, just stopped everybody dead by saying, "I suspect I'm the only person here who ever saw Paul VI in person." He said, "I accompanied a group of French students. I was in studies in Paris, and I accompanied this group to Rome, where they had an audience with the Pope, on those general audiences, you know, something in St. Peter's." He says, "I saw the Pope being carried in the Sedia Gestatoria." He said, "I saw the leader of Christendom." That sort of shut us up, where everybody was criticizing Paul VI. And one argument I would make is I think Paul VI probably was responsible for bringing the council through. And there's more continuity than discontinuity, but this is where many people would disagree with me. And this is partly because I tend to see this as a historian, that each pope is going to put his own mark on something. But nevertheless, I see more continuity in general, because you're not going to reverse something the previous pope did. The other thing is, if you go back to the 50s or 40s, Roncalli would report to the Pope pretty much through Montini. So it was a reversal of roles that took place. When Montini was made the Archbishop of Milan, he was not consecrated by the Pope. And when he left the Vatican, some suspicion of disgrace, but the other thing was maybe the Pope wanted to get him someplace where he could get out from this tension. So the very first cardinal whom John the 23rd named was Montini. So that's why I say I see more continuity, because he was a curialist. He knew how the machinery worked. I know a lot of other people disagree with me, but I think it probably would have never ended the way it did positively had it not been for the leadership of Montini.
They almost completed each other because...
Yeah, they were complementary. I see them as complementary.
Of course, John the 23rd was a historian, wasn't he?
Well, he started out teaching church history, and he did do a biography of Baronius, but he was also... If you read some of it, he was rather conservative in terms of scientific history.
He was the one who had this idea of improvisatio, no?
Which is something I would say is a certain spontaneity, which I think is true of the American church. But too many times now, I'm finding any spontaneity, people are going to watch. Like I had all the Eucharistic prayers memorized. Every now and then I'll slip and people will tell me, you used the older form of this prayer today. Well, at least they were paying attention. But still, the superficial is what grabs them. And any spontaneity is now sort of almost heretical.
So basically, both popes were understood in the United States.
I would say there was a great affection for John the 23rd, but what no Americans realized was under John the 23rd, the biblical scholars were put under suspicion. So under John the 23rd, the two professors at the Biblical Institute were forbidden from teaching seminarians.
On what grounds?
Complaints about their orthodoxy and so forth, like Maximilian Zervic was accused of denying that maybe there were three wise men. He was trying to put it in terms of the genre at the time, you know, the literary genre, all this type of thing. They were being accused of heresy.
And, interpretation.
Yeah, and John the 23rd finally forbade them to teach.
Something perhaps Paul the VI wouldn't have done.
Yeah, Paul the VI actually restored them. It's a complicated issue, and yet the popular image, John the 23rd, was grandfather figure, the picture of him when he was first elected. He smoked a cigarette once with when he was nuncio to Paris. He had a cocktail glass in his hand, a human side. But these are all on the superficial level. But underneath it, I'd say theologically, probably more was accomplished under Paul VI. You could debate this because John the 23rd died early. He was an older man. One of the things he did do that most people didn't know, including our CIA, he intervened in the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was obvious. But when he died, the Soviet Navy in Genoa Harbor flew their flags at half-mast. Somebody tried to argue with me. Well, after all, he was a head of state, as it was. The United States didn't fly any flags in Naples at half-mast. The British Navy did. I suspect the British commander could do it on his own, but certainly the Soviet commander could not. Orders came from the Kremlin. And it had to do with this loosening the Ostpolitik that John the 23rd started, which gradually was picked up, certainly by Paul VI, and then, of course, really capitalized on by Wojtyla, John Paul II.
So basically what happened at the council is that the council fathers all had a theologian who advised them, no?
Yeah, and then there were special theologians appointed by the Pope as theologians of the council. But after the first session, they seemed to all blend together. Certain theologians appointed by bishops to advise them also ended up as being very prominent. One example I can think of was in regard to the liturgy. The Benedictine Gottfried Dieckmann was a theologian of Cardinal Cicognani, who was then Secretary of State. He had been the American Apostolic Delegate. And Dieckmann was his personal theologian, but then he emerged as an important figure in drafting the Declaration, the Constitution on the liturgy.
Was there a contradiction between the actual event and the documents that eventually came out of the council?
It would depend. The first document that was promulgated was the liturgy. And that's why I said that was the first thing the Americans were aware of. And it came as a shock to many because, as I said, they make the immediate past normative for all the past.
Mm. They approved it in the second session, no?
Yeah. And most American bishops and priests did not know that the first bishop in the United States who proposed the vernacular liturgy was the first bishop, John Carroll. He spoke about it just before he was named the bishop. For him, this was absolutely essential because, after all, the liturgy should be pastoral and should be instructive. So this was shocking to many people when this was brought up. They have been taught this would never change. And, of course, it did change.
You were listening there to church historian and well-known author, Jesuit Professor Gerald Fogarty. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.